Part of the challenge going in, particularly with African Americans and thinking about religious liberty and race, is that while America was focusing on issues of religious liberty, they were at the same time holding people in bondage and in chains. So the first concern and question around with African Americans really had to do with how do we achieve our physical actual freedom, and especially achieving our actual physical freedom in light of how religion was used as psychological spiritual chains.
We had a lively interest in whatever the administration was doing with respect to church and state.
This is something that we fought hard for.
Religious liberty is one of the hallmarks and part of the bedrock of American democracy.
We at the BJC like to say when anyone's religious liberty is threatened, everyone's religious liberty is at risk.
Welcome to the BJC Podcast. I'm Amanda Tyler, the Executive Director of the Baptist Joint Committee. Today, I'm here with the Reverend Dr. Aidsand Wright Riggins, who's been a force in Baptist life for decades. He serves as the mayor of Collegeville, Pennsylvania, but he's also an ordained Baptist minister with more than 40 years of community and congregational service. He's been CEO of the American Baptist Home Mission Societies and Judson Press, and he served as a pastor in California and as the director of Peace with Justice with the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. So welcome, Aidsand, to the BJC Podcast.
Thank you, Amanda. It's wonderful to be here.
Well, you, of course, are here with us in the Kansas City area as our lecturer for 2019 Sheridan Lectures, and you are delivering two very challenging lectures for our community here, ones that I believe we all need to hear and ponder and move to action from after this week. You served on the BJC Board of Directors for more than two decades in your leadership role with ABHMS. Since you were preparing for these lectures, have you noticed any new thinking about how you approached the topic of religious liberty and separation of church and state?
I think so. I think as I began to think about the lectures and I began to think about the role of separation of church and state and how important that is, as well as the affirmation of religious liberties, I began to think much more about the connection between religious liberty and the issue of race, and how that functions both as a detriment to religious liberty, but at the same time an opportunity for persons to become much more resilient in fighting injustices, both with regards to race as well as fighting against assaults to religious liberty. So that was helpful to me to have an opportunity to think through that.
And I'm hopeful that your lectures will challenge us all to have a more inclusive approach to discussing religious liberty. You know, BJC's been around for eight decades, and we've had the involvement of African-American leaders and denominations from our beginning in the 1930s. But we have not often talked about how religious liberty and race intersect. So do you have any advice on the best ways that we as BJC, we as Americans who care about religious liberty, can do this?
Well, yeah, thank you. I think that part of the challenge going in, particularly with African Americans and thinking about religious liberty and race, is that while America was focusing on issues of religious liberty, they were at the same time holding people in bondage and in chains. So the first concern and question around with African Americans really had to do with how do we achieve our physical actual freedom, and especially achieving our actual physical freedom in light of how religion was used as psychological spiritual chains on people of color and in its early days. So the priority for people of color had really been racial justice, but also looking at how they were denied religious liberty. But at the same time, looking at how African Americans retranslated the gospel of the cross in such a way to be able to see that a different way of envisioning Jesus became not one that enslaved them further, but in fact gave them the resources and resilience to be able to fight for freedom and struggle for freedom. So I think that one entree that the Baptist Joint Committee and those who work with it, people of color and non-people of color, is to make that connection between how faith appropriately used becomes a real opportunity to move towards freedom, both religiously as well as in issues of race and gender and sexuality and other ways as well.
Yeah, I think that's a wonderful reminder about how when we approach religion from a more inclusive frame, all of our faith can be deepened.
Absolutely.
Would not that be the same if we can approach religious liberty by really, honestly, in a hard way, thinking about how this contradiction from the beginning, this sinful contradiction that was in the family of the founding fathers themselves.
Yes.
You know, if we can really do the hard work of talking about that in an honest way, how that might deepen our appreciation and protection for religious liberty.
Absolutely. And the challenge in our country is that it becomes incredibly difficult for us to talk about race, religion, gender, sexuality, because they're all so much the core of our being, but so many of the founding injustices were based on those very things. And so to work our way through that is not the easiest conversation to have, largely because almost in every instance of that conversation, there are people that are privileged. An example of that, I worked very hard, particularly in my college years and perhaps even during some of my seminary years, on issues of racial justice. But it never really occurred to me during those college years, as well as some of my seminary years, that I was looking for justice for the black man. In fact, the war we were waging was, quote, against the man, white man, and the benefits that we were looking for were for the black man. But it did not occur to me the privilege that black men had vis-a-vis black women. And so there are different levels of the struggle, and so it becomes very difficult for all of us, at whatever level our a privilege is, to be able to authentically and fully struggle and fight for the rights of both ourselves and others, because it really requires some level of shifting of privilege and benefits. And as we've learned, that power really concedes nothing without a struggle, whether it's a struggle against someone else or that internal struggle that one has to go through with oneself to be able to reconcile the brokenness in our own selves.
Yeah, and we all have those inherent...
We all have it.
...blind sides, that inherent privilege for someone, again, as compared to someone else.
Absolutely.
And so recognizing that, and I think the more that we can honor pluralism, right, and respect... not tolerance of others, but full freedom for each other, that we're all equals, that no one is here to tolerate someone else, but that we can get into that better mindset.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. We have to move beyond tolerance to an opportunity to really affirm the dignity and the humanity and the perspectives of others, and realizing that they are just as valid, if not more so, than our own.
Mm-hmm. So, of course, we're here for the lectures on religious liberty and separation of church and state. What do you see as some of the biggest threats to religious liberty that our country's facing right now?
I'm concerned about a number of things. One of the things I'm concerned about is how our pulpits are on the verge of being used or freed to become political platforms. I'm concerned how through current movements to allow not-for-profit organizations, churches, to be able to be used just like political parties. I think it is perfectly valid for communities to have an agenda for what makes our communities more just and focusing on common good and looking at persons from that perspective. But when a church is able to use its not-for-profit status and you use that bully pulpit for political means, I just don't like the interactions that are happening there in that way. So that's one of the things I would really be concerned with. And then another thing I'm concerned with, and I struggle with this, is how congregations are able to use some government funds for the benefit of the community, but you're still doing that from a religious perspective. I think it becomes a kind of a difficult road in which to walk, and a difficult, and in fact, perhaps even more so, a difficult relationship to maintain a degree of freedom from the government, the state, and the reception of those funds, still being about your principal business. And I know that especially in people of color communities, this becomes a real issue because the needs are so great. And how do you maintain your integrity, separation, at the same time use whatever meager resources you have for community transformation? Mm-hmm. So those are a couple of the things I'm concerned
about.
Yeah,
and of course, concerns that the BJC shares and Right. Things that we've been outspoken on in protecting the Johnson Amendment, and also Yes. Warning about the concerns, you know, reminding people why government funding of religion is a bad idea, and that Baptists have been speaking out against that for centuries.
And so often the purse strings end up pulling other strings, and so you have to be very, very careful with how you handle those relationships.
Yeah. Well, in the lecture you delivered at William Jewell College, you really gave a nice explanation of this legislative push that goes by the name Project Blitz.
Yes.
Can you maybe give a quick summary about Project Blitz and what some of the aims are there that you've picked up on?
One of the concerns that I have with Project Blitz really becomes a cudgel in the hands of religious right, and from my perspective, the white religious right, to try to remake the United States, the church, and faith in its own image. And in saying that, basically trying to nationalize Christianity as the religion. And in the process of doing that does, I think, irreparable harm to marginalized people, to people traditionally discriminated against, and people that are vulnerable. One of the strategies that they're using, it's a new playbook, but it's also an old playbook. Their new playbook is a 148-page playbook, which basically turns up the heat on the frog slowly but surely until the frog dies rather than jumping out of the pot. One of the ways they do that is by introducing, on the surface, somewhat kind of innocuous things that people say, well, that's no big deal. Let's begin to put "In God We Trust" on license plates. Let's begin to put it on police cars. Let's have an "In God We Trust" party or whatever. And people say, well, you know, we have it on our money. We got this and that. What's the harm of that? But slowly but surely, then they would begin to move to a second strategy. And that second strategy moves from innocuous pieces to then beginning to celebrate, I think, in inappropriate ways, Christianity as the more dominant, in fact, hegemonic kind of religion in this country. And then finally, really looking at a whole set of already prescripted, manufactured pieces of legislation to systematically deny the rights of others based upon, quote, my sincere religious beliefs that I have the right to be able to deny services to other people simply because I theologically disagree with them or their actions. And I think that is incredibly dangerous. But it's an old playbook. It's an old playbook in that the same kind of thing happened in racial justice. or in the civil rights movement, beginning to co-opt a movement by redefining terms, that turning, say, for instance, race on its head, that if I object to a racial insult, suddenly I'm being a reverse racist because I point out that kind of thing. So that's one of the real concerns that I have and one of the things I was attempting to speak to last night.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that's another important benefit to religious liberty, to having a more inclusive conversation. We can learn from the old playbook, and that might be the most effective way to combat the new one.
You
mentioned the danger of nationalizing Christianity or Christian nationalism. We also live in a time of that white nationalism is alive and well, not just in the United States, but around the world, as we recently saw in New Zealand. Are white nationalism and Christian nationalism the same? And if not, is there overlap?
I don't think that they're exactly the same, but there's certainly the overlap. And what they both have in common is white racism. When I talk about Christian nationalism, I'm really talking, and I think the term I like to use is Christian supremacy, is the idea that Christianity should predominate, and Christianity, in fact, propels us to dominate. I think with some perverted perspectives on evangelism, that denigrates others, that makes my particular faith supreme in the sense that it seeks to wipe out others. But white nationalism, which I argue really has its source in a theory of white Western dominance in this country, that it was then used to racialize other people, whether those be indigenous people, African Americans, Asians, who were discriminated against and treated so badly in the early history of this country, simply to provide labor and land and privileging other people. So you've got white nationalism, which I think leads to white privilege, but then you also have Christian nationalism, which leads to Christian privilege, and that becomes incredibly dangerous in putting those two together, which to me is one of the things that I see happening in recent political dialogue, political and religious dialogue.
Another topic that on the issue of racial justice that seems to be really popping up a lot now is the topic of reparation. It's not new, but I think a lot of people have been surprised that this has become a topic in the 2020 election among the Democratic candidates. And I know that you also touch on it in your lecture. How do you view the terms of reparation and reconciliation, and what do you think is the most productive way for us to talk about that? Because it seems like the country is starting to have a national conversation about this.
Well, first of all, I think it's just important to say that we need to have a national conversation and a real conversation about that. Secondly, I would say that the precondition for reconciliation and reparation is real repentance. Mm-hmm. You really have to know the history, and you really have to know what you have remorse and feel sorry about and confess of. And I think that our nation needs, I don't think our nation can fully, truly move forward in an authentic, transformative way without repentance. And we can't get to reconciliation without reparation. And when I say reparation, I'm not attempting at this point to say what reparation really looks like. There are a lot of things on the table in terms of how do we make whole? How do we flip the script in such a way our society is transformed? Right now, I'm just kind of thinking about people that win the lottery and all the stories I hear about poor people who get millions of dollars and then a few years later those millions of dollars are squandered. Well, that happens because there was no fundamental change in that person or in that situation that that person was in knowing how to handle that $1 million. So in the same way to me, I'm not so much interested in the handing out or the delivery of goods and services as much as I am concerned about how do we begin to rethink the structural narrative of the structures in this country that lead to the disparities in the first place. Example, it's amazing to me. I've always made a decent living. I've always had a pretty good income. But I live in a community that if you compare national averages, for every $5 that I have in wealth, that is real wealth, my neighbors have thousands of dollars in real wealth. So it doesn't matter that my income might be as much or more. We start off from a different playing field in terms of how we function. So to me, the conversation of reparations needs to be had in such a way that it is not simply the distribution of benefits for having suffered, but it's also really finding a way to change the system in such a way that it is of a more equal playing field for everyone going forward.
Mm-hmm. And that disparate, that's not an accident of birth. That was the policy of the country in which we were founded that created that change. And that's the piece of repentance,
right?
Is just learning that and really understanding it and repenting of that original sin of the founding of this country. Well, you talked about your community, and now you're a leader in your community. Since 2017, you've been the mayor of Collegeville, Pennsylvania. I think you probably view this as the next stage of your ministry in many ways, even though you're in a secular position, or I don't want to put words in your mouth. No. How do you view this experience? What has it been like compared to your other positions throughout the years?
Well, Amanda, I've been, quote, in professional ministry since I was 12 years old. I have made my living one way or another as a religious professional from the time I was 12 years old to the time I was 65 years old. And one of the primary reasons I decided to retire from professional ministry was because I wanted to have an opportunity to spend the rest of my life seeking to figure out what does it mean to be a Christian non-professional. I spent a lot of time as a religious leader, faith leader, trying to make the church Christian. And I wanted to step out of that church situation and see how I can make our communities more civil, based upon some of the values, not sectarian values, but just values related to what it meant to be concerned about the least of these and be in communion with others and be transformative in the midst of my community. So, I could look at it as ministry, but it is more the ministry of ministry in the workplace as a layperson, mm-hmm. attempting through the exercise of my faith to try to authentically be transformative and bring civility and character to the civil order.
Yeah. Well, I can say the people of Collegeville are fortunate that you are their leader and bringing all these years of experience and fighting for freedom to that community and your tremendous respect for religious pluralism.
Thank you.
As well. Of course, you're in Pennsylvania, a swing mm-hmm. state.
Yes.
We're March 2019, and we're already in full swing, it feels like, of the 2020 election. So it's going to be a long haul. And I was gratified that you mentioned as the number one threat this idea that our pulpits might be turned into campaign podiums mm-hmm. For speeches. What challenges do you see in your community, and maybe what opportunities are there for people to have a voice, to get involved in politics and advocacy?
Well, you know, when I made it, it was surprising to me how, I shouldn't say easy, but it was surprising to me at how simple a procedure it was even to decide to run for office and get into the political arena. One of the things I would just encourage people to do, especially the local level, is realize you can run for office and you can make a difference. And it only takes knocking on doors, hearing what people care about, and becoming engaged in your community. Filling out a few forms and saying, if nobody else will do it, I will do it. That's how I got into this. In our community, I'm most involved in Montgomery County, which is perhaps one of the strongest Democratic areas now in the state of Pennsylvania. But we saw in 2016 how vulnerable all of these, quote, swing districts could be. So one of the things that we had been engaged in Pennsylvania was being involved in fair districts, Pennsylvania, in terms of moving towards ending a lot of the gerrymandering. So we've been pushing a lot with regards to that, and we're successful in that. And as a result of that, in fact, the area in which I lived, we had four Congress people in that particular area with jurisdictions or areas kind of overlapping. We finally have one congressperson that I know that I can call on that represents Collegeville. Opportunities to register to people to vote still remains a real challenge for us. Making sure that we enlist college students in the electoral process are some of the things that we're really about in my area, the neck of the woods.
Yeah, we hadn't talked about this previously, but I worked for a member of Congress before this, and who is in one of the top 10 gerrymandered congressional districts in the country. And one of the things, and Republicans gerrymander, Democrats gerrymander,
yes.
it's a problem, right. Shared by both sides. Right. But one of the problems when it comes to citizen advocacy is just what you mentioned. If you divide communities into many different congressional districts, then it really leads to people feeling like they don't have a strong voice.
Right. Why do anything? Why say anything if you don't have somebody that you can call on or hold accountable?
Yeah.
And so that's another thing that we're doing is, even as an elected official, is having more town meetings and community forums and doing that in ways in which, say, I as the mayor of Collegeville, our representative for the 150th district there, our congressperson, and others are able to all come together with the community, and not just one of us, but all of us together, so that they are able to see the interconnections between all of these overlapping jurisdictions and services and that are provided, so people can really have honest conversations about what's going on. I don't think that there is one of the things that concerns me, Republican, Democrats, all of it, is the lack of accountability that many of our elected leaders have. In many ways, it's almost like we wind them up, let them go after the election, and we don't have to hear from them until the next election. But I really think one of the greatest things we can do is having an informed electorate that is in conversation with elected leaders and holding those elected leaders accountable, because these should not be privileged positions where we sit as princes and princesses, but rather as public servants to the population.
Yeah, and you know, when we talk about particularly religious liberty, I think with all the challenges that we find surrounding that right now, something I'm hearing a lot is, what can I do? What mm-hmm. can I do to stand up and do this? And so something BJC has done is set up a BJC advocacy team mm-hmm. where we can help people connect with their members of Congress so that they can let their voices be known, mm-hmm, you know, mm-hmm. that I care about these issues. And also when action alerts come up on things, for instance, like protecting the Johnson Amendment,
right.
you know, that they can have that direct line. And as you say, hold their members accountable.
Right.
Yeah. So obviously we've covered a lot of topics in this brief time. I just, as we close, is there anything else you'd like to share with our listeners?
Well, I would just share how grateful I am for the work of the Baptist Joint Committee, and how grateful I am for the 20 years of serving on its board. I think that the work that is done there is incredibly important work. I salute you and I salute the staff for the monumental task that you have before you and how well you do it. I think that our faith communities and communities of no faith are much better places because of the work that you do, and I just want to thank you for that.
Well, thank you, and thank you. We're so grateful for your many years of service to BJC and also for your sharing of your gifts and your current thinking on these really tough issues here for the 2019 Sheridan Lectures.
Thank you.
Thanks. Well, thanks for joining us today and listening to the BJC podcast. Take a moment to rate the BJC podcast on Apple Podcasts or share the BJC podcast however you listen to it, via Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, or on our website. And as always, be sure to follow us on social media. For more from BJC, visit our website at bjconline.org.